And I want you to imagine you're waking up now to the sound of birds. There's a breeze blowing through the trees outside your bedroom. Perhaps you can see some snow-capped mountains, because in this case, your window to the world is opened up by undoing a zip, because you sleep not in a room, but in a tent in the wilderness for months at a time, because that's the life you've chosen to live. For the last 8 years, Miriam Lancewood and her partner Peter have been living the nomadic lifestyle in New Zealand, Europe, and here in Australia. And Miriam has written about it in her book. It's a great account called Woman in the Wilderness. Miriam, hello.
Hello.
Welcome back to civilization.
Oh, thank you.
So-called.
So-called.
Yes. What is it like to be in a large city, having spent so much of the last 8 years not living around people?
Yes, it's very interesting. It's sort of overwhelming because it's so busy and you know, the traffic and that, it's a bit scary.
Is it?
It's very dangerous to be in a car. I mean, everyone knows that. You know, statistically, a lot of people die. But
some people would argue it's more scary to be alone with no visible means of support in a wild place where perhaps help could be literally days away.
Yes, that's right.
Yes. Are they wrong? Or?
They perceive it as being scary. But see, the wilderness is my home, so I feel very comfortable there. It's like you in your home. You're never scared at home, are you? Well, most people are not. You know, you feel comfortable, you know your way around.
Although one could argue that governments try to make us feel scared in our homes.
Yeah.
Because that's how they get votes for law and order.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's sad, isn't it? But I feel at home in the wilderness because over the years I've, you know my way around it. And it's fantastic to live in that beauty.
It's one thing for us as people to maybe take a few days away from our busy lives to go in search of nature and to communicate with it. It's another thing for you and your partner, Peter, to spend literally seasons at a time away from other people. How did you go about planning for that?
Planning, well, we spent about a year. I was working at the time as a teacher, and in the weekends we used to go out tramping, hiking, and camping in the mountains. And so we learned that, especially in the winter, about clothing, that woolen clothing is much better than plastic clothing, because the sparks of the fire make a little hole. And then a sand fly comes and bites you through the little hole. Those sort of little things you have to all learn and experience. And we read a lot of books about edible plants and mushrooms and other expedition books.
Yes.
What do people do in these sort of circumstances, you know, psychologically, what happens? And yeah.
So you put yourself through some mental and physical preparation. Did it work out to be what you needed? Was that enough to get you to the place you needed to be?
Yes, except for the hunting. I had practiced for a year on a target in the garden.
And now, we should talk about, what were you hunting with?
I started off with a bow and arrow. So I practiced archery on the target, and that went really well. You know, 20 meters every day, plonk, plonk, plonk.
Straight into the bullseye.
After a while, yeah.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, the hunting will be great success. I'll be little Robin Hood running around in the forest. But of course, once we're there, it was very difficult to find the animals.
Now, this is in New Zealand, first off, on the South Island.
Yeah.
What were you hoping you would hunt with your bow and arrow?
Well, I was sort of hoping for a goat or something, or a deer. You know, something with a little bit bigger target. It's not easier than a rabbit.
And so what was the first thing you successfully managed to shoot with your arrow?
With my bow and arrow was a goat.
Yep, it was a goat. One. Right. Yep. But that wasn't the first piece of meat you ate, though, was it?
No, indeed. It was a possum. So the possum we introduced from Australia, most people know, and they have accumulated greatly. Now millions of them, and they're classified as a pest. And the government is trying to find ways to get rid of them. So anyway, hunting is encouraged. And we took with us a possum trap. And we set off in autumn. And so it was very quickly very cold, because we moved into winter. And we got so cold that we're losing weight just by living. And in the morning, we wake up with hunger pains because just getting through the night caused so much energy. And so after a while, Peter was visibly losing weight. We said, okay, we got to get onto this hunting, which is my job.
Yes.
And so I put that.
He does the food. He cooks the food. You hunt the food, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And so I said, okay, I will catch this possum. So I put a trap out. And then one day, we were very happy, there was a possum in there. A very cute little possum looking at me. And I thought, oh, God. And so I had to smack the possum, but they're very tough animals and it's very hard to kill. And it was really a dreadful moment that I'm smacking it and wouldn't die. And in the end, Peter took over and I was absolutely traumatized and thinking, what am I doing here? These innocent animals are dying so that we can play little Robin Hood in the forest.
You wrestled with this off and on for a lot of your time in the wilderness, didn't you?
Yeah, that's right, especially in the first year, sort of. Because I grew up vegetarian. I never killed meat. I was always like, oh, no animal need to die for me. And so I was very judgmental to meat eaters. And so I ended up exactly doing that, killing animals to survive. Our situation was slightly different, but nevertheless, I felt very guilty. And these poor animals, it is very hard to kill an animal, and still is.
Miriam, I know that you found it difficult to dispose of the possum humanely. Peter, I think, finished it off, but you insisted on skinning it.
Yeah.
And then that was a bit of a catastrophe as well.
Oh, everything was a catastrophe. Yeah.
But then, what happened when you cooked it? What happened when you cooked and ate the meat?
Oh, so when Peter finally cooked it, it was absolutely amazing. It tastes fantastic. Just that meat gives so much energy, the wild meat. You know, people say you are what you eat, and that's definitely so very true with wild animals. You feel really so much healthier and stronger with eating good meat.
Miriam, you talked a little bit about the planning that you and Peter went through to take your lives away from the trappings of cities and towns and jobs and communities. How did your family and friends, because you're from the Netherlands originally, how did they feel about you going bush?
Well, we started off saying we're going for four seasons, so they didn't know we would be going bush for 10 years. And they were excited for us, and my parents were, you know, happy. And they say, how do we keep in contact? And I say, I will write letters. So I wrote letters, and then I had to wait. And sometimes I had to wait for weeks before I met another hunter. And then I would sort of run towards them and say, could you please post this letter for me? The stamps were already on it. They just had to put it in a post box. So they did send the letters to my parents. And when my parents opened the envelope, they would smell the smoke.
The wood campfire. Smoke. Yeah. Because your whole life was around fire.
Yeah. So everything smells of smoke. My hair still does. All our clothing, you know, you can smell us for, you know, 100 meters.
Now, you may say that you've learned that nature is your home, mm-hmm. but in reading your book, you had to face some pretty strong fears within yourself just to keep living in the wilderness. Do you want to tell people about some of those?
Yes.
Because you have a fear of being alone.
Yes.
Even though you were alone.
Yes, no, I'm not alone, I'm with Peter.
You're with Peter, that's right.
Yes, that's right. So we're always together. So you get very used to, you know, being around someone else. And then to go off on my own is very different, especially when you're walking by yourself on a mountain you've never been. And then it suddenly, I started off walking on my own, and then suddenly found myself in the snow, and I didn't expect to be in the snow. And I thought, oh, my God, this is much more extreme. And I started to think, well, if something happens, then search and rescue has to find me. I better make footprints in the snow, that sort of thing, you know.
But you had no telephone.
No telephone.
No radio.
So search and rescue would come way too late. But anyway, never anything like that happened. But, I had to overcome that fear of doing it. But you can only overcome it by doing it.
Yes.
Right?
And you talk about fear of ghosts to inhabiting a hut in New Zealand. And you had to face your own fears about that. I mean, it's not like, I mean, you sound like this brave, strong woman, and you are. But like any human being, you have frailties.
Yes,
and,
of course.
And flaws. Yeah. And some of those are exposed when you're under duress, under stress, yeah?
Yeah, that's one of the things I learned also in the wilderness, that my fears and all that are really not that individual.
No.
Or what I feel, millions of people feel the same. So I'm not ashamed of those fears. Everyone got them.
So let's talk about, you talked about eating meat, and you talked about meeting those fears and sort of coming to grips with them. And you actually read a lot of philosophy while you're out there as well and discussed things with Peter.
Yeah. So we take one book with us, and it's going to be, you know, a bit of a difficult book. Otherwise, it's a bit boring.
Yes.
So we keep reading that. At the moment, we're reading Friedrich Nietzsche.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
And is Nietzsche useful for being out in wilderness?
Not useful. It's interesting.
My guest, by the way, if you just joined us, is Miriam Lancewood. She and her partner, Peter, have chosen to be as much as possible living a life in nature. Most of this time, it's been spent in New Zealand, but they've also spent time in Europe. So if you don't mind me telling people, Peter is 30 years older than you, and a 30-year difference doesn't make a huge difference when everyone's younger, but now he's in his mid-60s. Does that mean the conversations start to change about your lifestyle?
Yes, indeed. So after this long walking business, he, of course, his body recovers much slower than mine. So he needs a lot more rest. So especially for his sake, I could keep on walking another few thousand kilometers, but he needs to rest. And fair enough, you know, I'm happy anyway. In either way. So,
well, in fact, you write in the book about how Peter said, look, I want you to know you're free to go anytime you want, because you need to find freedom if you want to move on to something else.
Yes.
And you cried, didn't you?
Yes. Yeah, it's very touching when he say those things. I mean, there is a fear of that, you know, he too, that he get left behind or that we have to separate. And of course, those are sad things. But you knew that from the beginning. I mean, I was 22 when I met him and he was 52. And right from the beginning, we knew that, you know, we spend time together and maybe there's a time apart as well. But yeah, just him saying that you're free to go, it's already give me a feeling of freedom.
Yeah.
So I don't feel chained. I don't feel locked in with him. So that's great.
So you've got to find a year to sit down and be with each other in one place. What do you two talk about when you've lived so long in each other's pockets and relied on each other so much for that time?
Well, that's where the philosophy books come in. And we talk about those topics and discuss these things. Yeah, we always got something to talk about. Never seemed to be a problem.
And are you finding that more and more women are inspired since you've written the book and published it, that they want to follow in your footsteps?
Yes, but I still don't find them out there in the wilderness. There are plenty of women walking the trails and the tracks, but I don't see them outside in the wilderness. But I like to see more women, and I like to encourage them. Then you don't have to be afraid. It's nothing to be afraid of.
Yes, there is.
Oh, in Australia, perhaps. With the snakes and the crocodiles. But New Zealand has no dangerous animals. No. So, you know, why are there men out there and no women?
Have you been trying to organise an expedition just with women?
Yes, that's right. So I'm trying to get women hunters and to come with me on an expedition just to see if we can live off the land entirely from hunting and fishing and gathering and pull together our skills. But they're very hard to find. In fact, I have not found one woman.
So the challenge is out there, Miriam.
Yes, that's right. And I put on my little movie on YouTube last February, and I've not found one experienced woman who can also walk with a backpack, you know, long walking.
Do they have to know how to shoot a bow and arrow?
No, you can also be experienced with rifles. Yeah.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, then. Rifles are good. Yeah.
And do they have to eat goat and possum and deer?
Yeah, well, that's the whole idea. We've got to survive out there of hunting and fishing, yeah. So, yeah, we'll see how that goes.
You're an admirable person. It's really lovely to meet you. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.